morning, and we just want to say that there is none like you. No one loves us like you do. No one has sacrificed for us like you have, Jesus. Father, you've never given up on us. Throughout all of sacred history, you've continued to initiate relationship with us. And we, as your people, have turned away and gone our own way, but you keep coming back. You keep coming back. You never have given up on us. And even today, when we get caught up in our own little lives and we tend to leave you out, you never look and say, "Ah, it's not worth it." You never turn your back on us, even though sometimes we turn our backs on you. And God, that humbles us. It makes us realize that our heart's true home is in you. And so as we come to your word this morning, we want to be attentive to you, Father. We want to hear your word. We want to respond to it. We want to see our lives change so that we become more and more like Jesus. Because that's what the world needs to see. He's who the world needs to see today. So we ask that you would work in us as we are attentive to your Spirit's voice. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Well, good morning. It is good to see you on this Memorial Day weekend, and I'm still trying to figure out what Jason is talking about. I know he's talking about one thing. He's told me a couple of weeks now that I'm scratching my elbow like this. So if you see me this morning, you know, doing this during the message, then everybody cross their arms and just start scratching their elbow, and I'll go, "Okay, all right, I get it. Last week we talked about how we as a people are connected to the past, to what God has been doing since he created this world. And we talked about what we sense God doing in us and among us and through us here at Southside. And we had talked specifically about that what we see God doing here is that he's using this community of faith, this fellowship, to reintroduce people to Jesus and the life that he offers. And every week when we open the Bible, our goal is to reintroduce you to Jesus and his life. And I think that's huge. I think it is huge for people today to become followers of Jesus, for Christians to start becoming followers of Jesus, because for too long we have been content to be listeners to preachers rather than followers of Jesus. And what's interesting to me is that when Jesus called 12 disciples to follow him, to be with him, as they followed him, he teaches them how to live. Not just how to go to heaven when they die, not just how to teach other people how to go to heaven when they die, but he teaches people how to live. And he takes these disciples at the end of his ministry and he says, "Now, I want you to go out into all the nations and I want you to teach them what I've taught you. I want you to teach them how to live my kind of life." And this past year in men's fraternity, we've taken a passage in John chapter 10, verse 10, where Jesus came and he said, "I came that you might have life and have it more abundantly," or have it to the full. And we have said that basically my paraphrase of that is that Jesus came to give us the best possible life. He came to show us how to live the best possible life. Now, it seems to me that if we take Jesus seriously, then the way of Jesus, the way Jesus teaches us to live, that's got to be the best possible way to live, or else Jesus is a liar. And you think about it. We've talked about how people today have heads full of misconceptions about Jesus and Christianity and the church. And somebody might say, "Yeah, but you know what? I've been around Christians and I've been around churches. And to be honest with you, it's pretty boring. I mean, those people are pretty lame. They're petty. They're divisive." And if that's the observation that people make about the church of Jesus, then either the church is not living in the way of Jesus or Jesus is a liar. Because you see, it's possible to say that you're a Christian and say that you're a Christian church and actually miss the life that he offers. Or maybe those people weren't true followers of Christ, or they weren't living out the way of Jesus, or Jesus is just a flat-out liar. And you shouldn't listen to anything he has to say, because it seems to me that if Jesus came and he said, I came to show you how to live the best possible life, then it seems like that the reputation of those who follow him, the observation out in the world ought to be, now there's a group of people who really know how to live. There's a group of people who are learning to live what looks to me like the best possible way to live. Are you following me here? I mean, doesn't that make sense? If Jesus came and he said, I came to show you the best possible way to live, and I want you to go teach others how to live this kind of life, doesn't it make sense that if we are following him, then the reputation of the church ought to be, now that's a group of people that really know how to live. Well, let me ask you, I mean, are those the kinds of things, is that the kind of things people are saying about the church of Jesus? I'll tell you, one thing you can say about that group down there, they really know how to live. You see, if we've missed that, we have missed something at the core of what it means to be a Christian. Because either the Christian life is the best possible way to live, or Jesus is a liar. Now, one of the things that we've been learning in our study of James, and if you are just joining us this morning, we study through whole books of the Bible, and we've been studying a letter in the New Testament written by James, who is the brother of Jesus and one of the leaders of the early church in Jerusalem. And James has been telling us that, you know, the best possible way to live, that doesn't necessarily mean it's the easiest way to live. It's not necessarily the most pain-free way to live. It's not the least confusing way to live, because Jesus himself, I mean, Jesus suffered and he dies on a cross. He's tortured, beaten, stripped, naked. And on the cross, he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? And so apparently the best possible life doesn't mean the easiest, most pain-free, most problem-free, pressure-free life, but the life that Jesus makes possible is either the best possible way to live, or Jesus is a liar. And James is writing to Christians who are living under pressure. Their lives are filled with all kinds of problems and trials, and James knows, just like you know, that when you encounter hard times, your heart can become humble or it can become hard. And evidently, many of James' readers were upset with God for allowing all these bad things to come into their lives. And they were in church and they were listening to sermons, but they weren't putting into practice what they heard. Evidently, they were beginning to doubt God's goodness because of all these trials that had come upon them, all these difficulties. And they were trying to find a way out. They wanted relief. And basically, what James is saying in this letter is that when you go through hard times, what you believe has to work itself out into the way you live, or it doesn't do you or anybody else any good in this life. And beginning in chapter 3, go ahead and take your Bible and turn to James chapter 3. James contrasts two ways to live. We can live our lives governed by a heavenly wisdom or an earthly wisdom. Heavenly wisdom flows from faith and shows itself in humility. Earthly wisdom flows from selfishness and shows itself in pride and arrogance. So look at James chapter 3, verse 13. Let's review for a few moments this morning, since we've had a couple of weeks away. Verse 13, who among you is wise and understanding? Notice this, let him show. That's what James is about. Show. It's important. It fits with what he's been saying. Show your faith. Live out your faith. Live out what you believe in difficult times. Let him show. How? By his good behavior, his deeds, in the gentleness of wisdom. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, don't be arrogant and lie against the truth. This so-called wisdom is not from above. It's earthly and natural and demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there's disorder in every evil thing. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, and gentle, and reasonable, and full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without hypocrisy. And the seed whose fruit is righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. In the trials of life, there are two ways we can live. We can live by faith, which shows itself in humble, patient, peaceable, merciful life of helping others in need, or we can become proud and arrogant, more and more self-focused. There's two ways to live, a faith-oriented life or a self-oriented life, a humble way of life or an arrogant way of life. And the fact is, most of us waver between the two. Now, James goes on in chapter 4. He continues to develop this thought in verses 1 through 3, where he questions his readers. He says, you guys are being torn apart by all these conflicts because of selfishness. You just want what you want, and you're going after it with all of your heart. It's just selfish. And then in chapter 4, verses 4 through 10, James accuses them of committing spiritual adultery and betraying their friendship with God. Look at verse 6. He says, God is opposed to the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. Look down in verse 10. So humble yourselves in the presence of the Lord, and he will exalt you. See, this contrasting way of life, a humble way of life that issues from faith, an arrogant way of life that issues from selfishness. And then in chapter 4, verses 11 and 12, and we really haven't touched on these verses, and this is just kind of a parenthesis, because this is not what I want to talk about this morning. But since we haven't covered them, there is a thought in here that just blew my mind, and it ties in with the whole train of thought here. But in chapter 4, verse 11 and 12, he applies what he's been saying to humility about the tongue. And that's something that he's had in mind since the beginning of chapter 3. He says in verse 11, do not speak against one another, brothers. He who speaks against a brother or judges his brother speaks against the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you're not a doer of the law, but a judge of it. There's only one lawgiver and judge, the one who's able to save and destroy. But who are you to judge your neighbor? Now, if you think about this, this takes the problem we have with the tongue to a whole new level. To speak against someone is any kind of negative talk that is harmful to the reputation of another person. Being critical, cynical, blaming, accusing, judgmental, finding fault with another person, he has all that in mind. And he says, it's not when we gossip, when we slander, when we talk bad about people, it's not just that we're breaking a rule. He says that we're setting ourselves up as a judge. He says we're judging the law, and he's talking about the royal law that he referred to in chapter 2, verse 8, which is Jesus' law of love, to love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus took that and lifted that out of Leviticus 19, 18, love your neighbor as yourself. And just before that, in verse 16, it says, do not go about as a talebearer among your people. You see, you cannot love your neighbor as yourself and go around telling other people about how bad your neighbor is or how they've failed or how they've faulted you in some way. And again, this just blows my mind because he's saying to talk bad about people, it doesn't just simply violate the law of love, but James says you set yourself up as judge over that law. When you spread gossip and talk bad about people, you're not just judging people. Here's the point, and this is how it comes into pride. He says you're putting yourself in the place of God. You are playing God with that other person's life because there's only one lawgiver. Only God can judge rightly. Only God knows what's going on in somebody's life and circumstances in their heart. And he says you're playing God when you look at other people and spread gossip and slander and be critical and negative and find fault with them. See, so this is really about humility. It's the two contrasting lifestyles of faith, which shows itself in humility, or selfishness that shows itself in pride and arrogance. That's why he says in verse 12, who are you to judge your neighbor? Now, he doesn't mean that we're not to be discerning. We as followers of Jesus have to be able to judge between right and wrong. And if we see a brother or sister engaging in something that is clearly wrong, then we are called upon to go and confront that brother and sister humbly, in love, and call them back to faithfulness. Look over in chapter 5, verse 19, so that we just don't run off on some tangent and miss the point. In chapter 5, verse 19, he says, "My brothers, if any among you strays from the truth and someone turns him back, then let him know that he who turns a sinner from the error of his ways will save his soul from death and cover a multitude of sins." James says, if you judge something to be wrong in someone's life, then you go and you get involved in it. You don't go around talking about it with other people. But if you see something, then yes, you go and you try to lovingly and humbly win that person back. But you don't arrogantly sit back and talk about the person behind their back and spread negative, critical, judgmental stuff behind them. You don't find fault. Finding fault and telling the dirt that you see in other people's lives, he says that is the essence of arrogance. He says it's prideful. He says you're playing God with that person. It's not simply being naughty. Yeah, I know, I got a little problem with gossip, and I really ought to work on that. No, 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 no. He says it's arrogance. It's pride. And so, God, and he says that God opposes the proud. Now, James, that's just aside. That could be a whole message in itself, but it ties in so well with where we're going. Because James continues this rebuke of pride as we come down to this passage that we want to center on this morning. Because he's calling people to live like Jesus, to live in humble submission to God. And so he says in verse 13, "Come now, you who say, today and tomorrow we'll go to such and such a city, and we'll spend a year there, and we'll engage in business and make a profit." And James says, yet you say these things, you make these plans, yet you don't know what your life will be like tomorrow. Don't you understand you're like a mist, you know, that appears for a little while, like dew on the morning grass. It appears for a little while and then it vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that. But as it is, look at this, you boast in your arrogance, and all such boasting is evil. Again, the issue is a self-sufficient pride. And he's saying that we sometimes live our lives as if we're the captain of our ship. I make my plans and I plan my way. And it's the same problem that he was talking about in verses 11 and 12, where people are playing God by judging their friends. He's saying you're playing God by planning your future and leaving God out. And he says that's arrogance. It's to boast that you are in control of your destiny. I will do this. Here's point number one. When we live in a future of our making, we are playing God with our lives. When we live in a future of our own making, we're putting ourselves in the place of God. We're playing God with our lives. See, he just said when we judge others, we're playing God with other people's lives. But when we plan our future and leave God out, we're playing God with our lives. And that is arrogance. He's, I will do what I want to do. And I have the ability to make my future better. And he says, no, you don't really even know what's coming tomorrow. Now, don't miss the point here. James is not saying that we shouldn't plan, because he says right after this, if we should say if the Lord wills, we'll do this or that. So he's not against planning. You can't live in this world without planning. You've got business you got to do. You've got things coming up with your kids. I mean, Art Ringer just had a wedding yesterday, last child got married. You can't not plan a wedding. He's not talking about planning just, he's not talking about making a profit. He's not against making a profit. What he's dead against, he's against pride. A pride that makes plans and leaves God out, or a pride that makes God, or a pride that plans the future and then asks God, God, will you bless my plans? Rather than having a demeanor, a way of going about life where you're saying, God, what is it that you want me to do? God, here's this opportunity. Now, to get from here to there, there's a couple of things that have to be worked out. But God, what is it that you want? He's talking about living your life, again, in the midst of trials and difficulties and hardship. What's the temptation? It's to jump ship. It's to try to sail this ship into smoother waters. He's saying, no. You patiently endure that trial, and you, if you have opportunities for the future, you just hold yourself up before God and you say, God, what is it that you want? And then you allow God to shape your plans. The mind of a man plans his way, but God directs his steps. And James goes on to say why it's really impossible to, you're not in control of your destiny. You're not the captain of your fate. He says it's impossible because, number one, we have no knowledge of what tomorrow will bring. Look at verse 14. Yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. And, so that's the first thing. And two, we have no assurance of a long life because he says, your life is like a mist. It's like a vapor. It's here today, gone tomorrow. You don't know what is coming and you don't know how long you've gotten. God. So what he's saying, and the reason he's saying this, again, is because he knows that in trials, the temptation, remember, every trial has a temptation, carries with it a temptation to leave God out, to go your own way. And what he's talking about here is going our own way by planning our own way. It's easy to take the path of least resistance. It's easy to look for a quick way out by making plans that put you in the driver's seat. He says, instead of making your plans and thinking that you're in control, verse 15, instead you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that. Now, he's not saying that you ought to punctuate every sentence with, well, you know, we're going to go to McDonald's for lunch today if the Lord wills. You know, or tomorrow morning I'm going to wear jeans and a red shirt, God willing. He's not, that would be like taking the Lord's name in vain. He's not trivializing that. What he's saying is, again, submit your future plans to God. Only he knows what tomorrow will be like. And when we live in the future, in a future of our own making, we are playing God. So, to walk by faith changes our attitude not only about our friends, but it changes our attitude about the future. So he's talking about two ways to live, a humble way of life that comes from a faith-based orientation and a proud and arrogant way of life that judges other people and gets into conflicts and quarrels all the time and tries to make the future work for us. But there's something else here. I was reading a commentary this past week, and the writer said, the letter of James has less about Jesus' life than any other letter. Yet no other epistle reflects more of Jesus or contains as many echoes of his words. And I thought that's really true. What James says here is an echo of something that Jesus said. So I want you to keep your finger in James, and I want you to turn back to Matthew chapter 6. In Matthew chapter 6, Jesus is wrapping up a long teaching about the necessities of life, food and clothing, and he's been encouraging his hearers not to worry about all of these things, all of these necessities of life that can consume us, if we don't stay focused on God and his kingdom. And then he sums up that teaching in verse 34. He says, so do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will take care of itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. One translation is, let the day's own trouble be enough for that day. Don't worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. Jesus says, you got today, and today has its own issues. Today has its own baggage. Today, there's enough trouble in today for you to be concerned about. Tomorrow's going to bring its own stuff. That makes sense, right? I mean, tomorrow we're going to have a new set of issues, and it's probably good today that we don't know what's coming tomorrow, because we'd be really worried then, and we would be going around going, oh man, I just can't believe, is this really going to happen? No, we don't know what's coming. He says today has enough to care for and to think about for just today. Now, go back to James. James is echoing Jesus here. He's talking about people who boast about what they're going to do tomorrow. They arrogantly talk about what's going to happen and how it's going to be better tomorrow and what they're going to accomplish tomorrow. And James says, that's foolish because you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. When it comes to tomorrow, he says you have no guarantees. You don't have anything that you can count on for sure. You only have today. Now put James and Jesus together. Jesus says, let today be enough because tomorrow will bring its own stuff. James says, don't live in tomorrow because you don't even know if you're going to have it tomorrow or not. You see that? Don't live your life in the future. Don't live your life wishing for better times tomorrow. You don't know what's coming in the future. You can't be God. You can't play God. Yes, God is in control of the future, but he's not in the future. God's in the present. Now, I want you to think about this. What is on your Palm Pilot right now? What is written on the list on the refrigerator or on your grease board? What's written on your hand or on the back of your hand in ink? What is it that's coming up tomorrow or this afternoon or next week that is taking up your head space right now? What is it that's in your head that's causing you to live off in the future? Maybe it's a phone conversation that got really awkward and the person hung up on you and you have to go back and fix it, and you're thinking about you got to make that call. Or maybe it's that thing you did and you know you really didn't do that good of a job on it, and so you're going to have to go back and you're going to have to make that right. Or maybe it's something that you've been avoiding and you keep putting it off and putting it off and putting it off, but you know that sooner or later you're going to have to deal with that, and that's hanging out there in the future. How much of what is up here is out there in the future, somewhere out there? Jesus says, let today be enough. James says, you don't know what your life is going to be tomorrow. I would say that there's the big idea of what James and Jesus are saying. If I was to pull those two thoughts together into one statement, they would be saying, learn to be fully present to the moment. Learn to be fully present here, now, in this place, with these people, to really be where you are. I'd say that's one of Jesus' main teachings on what it means to live the best possible life. That's one of James' main teachings about what it means to walk by faith in the midst of difficulties. Both James and Jesus are teaching us how to be fully present. Jim Elliot, a young missionary who was killed by South American natives, he said it this way. He said, wherever you are, be all there. Wherever you are, be all there. Wherever you are, be there, not somewhere else. And I have to confess to you, I'm 50 years old, and this is something that I have struggled with all of my life. I mean, when I was in high school, it was all about getting out of high school and getting to college. And when I was in college, it was all about getting through college and then getting married. And then after getting married, it was all about getting that first job and getting set up. And then it was about having kids. And then it was about another child and another job. And it was more about, life was more about the next thing in the day timer. And about 10 years ago, I wrote in my journal, I wrote this: as I look back on my life, it feels like I've never been where I was at the time. I've always been on my way to somewhere else. And there is a pride about that. There's an arrogance to that, thinking that things will be better at such and such a place, at such and such a time. And I got to get there. I got to get there as fast as I possibly can. And the problem is, what happens is, you miss God. Because God is at work in the present. He's not off in the future. He knows the future, but He's not there. He's here. And you know it's a problem when you notice when your children tell you the same thing over and over again. You know, when they come and repeat themselves over and over, several times in a row, they kind of learn. You know, when you talk to Dad, you got to say things over and over again because Dad's not here. He's not here. He's somewhere else. Now, they wouldn't be able to articulate it that way, but kids sense these things. I mean, they know if they're safe. Kids know if they're loved. And they know if you're there. I mean, you're in the middle of the floor playing Legos, but you're not there. You're not there. You're still at work. Your head is not there. And so what kids learn to do is they just learn to, you know, if you're going to get Dad's attention, you're going to have to repeat it over and over and over and over. Do you know what I mean? Are you someone who is either thinking about what you have to do or thinking about what you did that you still have to deal with so that you are rarely where you are? Some of you know exactly what I'm talking about because you woke up all of a sudden and you're in this steaming hot graduation gown and you're thinking, where did those 4 years go? Or all of a sudden your last kids left the house and you're going, where did the time go? Or you come to the end of the vacation and you're like, what happened? I mean, we had 2 weeks. It's just like, it was just gone. We go and we go and we go and we're thinking about what has to be done. How often are we fully present here, now, in this place with these people? It's one of the greatest hindrances to worship. Because we're here and the music is playing and people are leading, but we've got our to-do list out. And we're thinking about what's coming this afternoon or next week. Jesus says, let today be enough for today. James says, you don't even know if you're going to have it tomorrow. Concentrate on today. Now, the rabbis had a fascinating observation about human nature. I want you to keep your finger again in James, but turn with me to the book of Exodus. Exodus chapter 24. This is a passage where God is talking with a man named Moses, and he's giving him some instructions. And Moses is with these leaders, there are about 70 of them, and they go up and they see God, and God has some specific commands to give this man named Moses. And there's something here in Exodus 24, verse 12, that we miss in English that the rabbis pick up on. And they point out in the original language, which is Hebrew here. If you have a New American Standard, you can see this in the marginal reading. But the text reads, come up to me on the mountain and stay here. Come up with me on the mountain and remain here. And I think the translators have it remain here or stay here because it makes more sense to them. Come up on the mountain and stay here. The problem is it doesn't say that in the Hebrew. The rabbis point out it's not how it reads. The word stay, translated in our Bible, stay or remain, is the word hayah. And it's a form of the word to be or to exist. So the rabbis point out that this verse should read, come up on the mountain and be here. Well, I mean, just think about that. If Moses climbs to the top of the mountain and he's on the top of the mountain, where would he be? Not a trick question here. If he climbs to the top of the mountain, where is he? He's on the top of the mountain. And so the rabbis say that in this verse, either God is stuttering, you know, or something else is going on here. Moses, come up to the top of the mountain and be here. And the rabbis say that God understands how we are wired. He understands that we'll start out to climb the mountain and we will exert a tremendous amount of energy getting up to the mountain, top of the mountain. But as soon as we get to the top of the mountain, what do we start to think about? Going down the mountain. I've told you about this before, but it's always tickled me how my family growing up, you know, we would drive to North Carolina and then we would sit on the front porch at my grandmother's house every night and we would talk about how we got there, and for an entire week we would talk about the route that we would take going back. It never made sense. Well, we came up 301, 601, then we took that there, and you know, and I think, but this time I think we're going to go back this way. This was before interstates. That was just like, you know, after the flood, but anyway. God knows how we're wired. We'll exert all of this energy getting up the mountain. When we get to the top of the mountain, we're thinking, oh boy, I got to go down the mountain. Which means we end up missing the whole point of the journey. God understands how we're wired. And he wants to speak to Moses. He has something to say to Moses. And God says, Moses, when you go up on the mountain, be here. So when I talk with you, you're here, you're attentive, right here, right now. You're not on your way up, huffing and puffing, and you're not thinking about the strenuous journey on the way down. I want you here, fully present with me. How often are you fully present to the moment? Jesus says, let today be enough for today. James says, you have no idea what your life is going to be like tomorrow. Now, let's just really bring this down to where we live. How many of you have one of these? Pretty much everybody. Let's see. Yeah. Now, I just love that sound, don't you? I mean, especially like when you're relaxing in the evening at home and you hear this sound going off and it's just, I'd give it about a 45. You know, it's just, you can kind of sway to it. It's so relaxing. I think I see a sunset. It's just, oh, it's so great. I mean, now, how many of you, if you are honest, would say, if there's one metaphor that describes your life, it would be a cell phone. Someone's calling you, you got work to do. Someone's calling you, you got stuff to do. Someone's calling, you got to make that deadline. Someone's calling, you got to be here and you got to be in the next place. Someone's calling and you need to meet them there. You need to know how to get there and where to meet them. You got all these things you have to do. And you have all these things you have to accomplish. You got all these places that you have to go. You got to make a profit. You got to know what's the next thing going on in the stock market. You have to answer that call, because if you don't answer that call, the world as we know it will come to an end. I'm going to stop. Let me just stop that. Think about the cell phone. It does something to relationships. I'm not against cell phones. But just think about this. Think about this. You and I go out to lunch, and we're at lunch, and my cell phone rings. Now, immediately what happens? And we're connecting with each other. We're having this deep conversation with each other, and my cell phone rings. And so immediately you're thinking, I wonder if he's going to answer that. I wonder if he's going to answer that. Now, if I don't answer it, and I just reach down and I push it off, we still had a little bit of interruption. But if the cell phone goes off and I answer it, then you know where you are on the friend totem pole. right? Because, I mean, you thought you were here, but now you realize you're down here. We were connecting. We were having this great conversation. But there's someone and something else more important than me being here with you in this place at this time having this conversation. Because the cell phone rings. You know, and then there's those awkward moments when you know, you answer your cell phone, or you're with a person and they answer the phone, and they're chatting away, and you know, they're looking at you, and you know, they're doing this. So or it's even more awkward when they kind of turn around in their seat, you know, and you're talking, and you're going, what do I do? I mean, they're talking to somebody else. I'm not sure, you know, it's that awkward moment. You don't know if you should make eye contact or should you just kind of look away while they're the only ones. Technology is a wonderful thing. It allows us to do all sorts of things we couldn't do before. I mean, especially, you know, just think about how it's so essential for doctors and surgeons. I mean, to be able to be contacted. I'm not against cell phones, but we need to understand that the technology of our day carries ramifications with it that affects being fully present to the moment. If we are living in the future, we're living somewhere else, it can fracture relationships. And we have all of these ways of connecting today, yet if we don't understand what it means to be fully present, again, not that a conversation can't get interrupted, but if we don't embrace what it means to be fully present, then we end up missing God, who is present in the moment. And we end up with fractured relationships because we're living like, I'm not really here. I'm on my way to somewhere else. And we miss God. You ever been over to somebody's house where, you know, it was just one of these evenings where you spent about 2 or 3 hours and after you ate the meal, nobody got up from the table. You just kind of sat there and you talked. And when you got in the car to go home, you went, man, wasn't that a great evening? I mean, wasn't it great to be with those people? I mean, you got caught up and it was like something, it did something to your soul down deep. It was just so relaxing and so enjoyable. You didn't have to be somewhere else. You were just right there with those people in that place. And it felt so good. You know why that is? Because God wired us that way. To enjoy that kind of relationship with one another. But when we turn everything into some kind of utilitarian purpose where, yeah, we're going to eat supper there, and then we're going to run here, and then we're going to go there, and then we're going to do this, that fractures our souls. It disrupts relationships. But the reason it feels so good, the reason that we crave it, is because that's the best possible way to live. Look at Jesus, look at his life. He was always eating with people, dining with Pharisees, dining with tax gatherers and prostitutes, sitting around a campfire eating fish and chips with his men, sitting on the side of a mountain eating. And these meals back then were 3-4 hour events where you laid down on couches and you talked and you visited and you were with people. You were really there. You say, well, you just don't understand. I mean, Jesus didn't live in my world. Implication is, I'm really busier than Jesus. I don't think so. I don't think so. Well, I'm out to change the world, change my business world. Jesus came to change the world. The argument, well, you just don't understand. I mean, I just can't get control of my world. No, I understand. And James would say, you don't understand. It's just foolish to live as if you are in control of your own destiny and not be where you are. You see, what we're talking about this morning, being fully present to the moment, is the best way to live. And if it's not, then Jesus is a liar. and he lived a lie. Now let me ask you, what does it mean for you to be fully present? What does it mean for you? Think about your life, family, friends. Are you fully present with them? Or are you there, but you're not really there? For you to be fully present, do you need to humble yourself and go to somebody and say, you know what? I got to confess to you. We haven't been connecting. And the reason is because I'm always thinking about someone or something else. And I haven't been with you. And by God's grace, I want to see that change. Are you constantly planning and living in the future? So much so that you're not where you are. Are you going through some kind of trial? And yeah, it's not pleasant. But because of the difficulty and the hard time, you're just thinking, I got to get out. I got to get rid of this. I got to do something different. And you're thinking and you're planning and you're strategizing about then and there. But you're refusing to live here and now. God is only here and now. Don't play God with your future. Being fully present to the moment is the best possible way to live because it is the only way to live. And look at how James concludes this section. Here's a verse that we rip out of context all the time. Therefore, to the one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin. What's the context for that verse? Living out in the future. The context for this verse has to do with living now. See, again, we don't think of that as sin. We don't think of it. We just think of it, well, I'm busy. I'm just busy. I just got too much to do. James says to the one who knows the good thing to do, the good thing is to live here, now. Be where you are. That's where God is. That's where God is speaking. That's where God is working in your life and in the people around you, in their lives. Jesus says, let today be enough for today. You can't really live in the future. And if you try, you miss your life. If you try, you miss the whole point of the journey. Let today be enough for today, because you don't know what your life is going to be like tomorrow. Would you bow with me?